Welcome to this week's Ortho Digest Rundown for June 1st, 2026. This week we indexed 476 new orthopedic studies across 34 journals. The 75 highest impact studies are featured on the site, and we're covering the top 25 studies in this audio digest. As always, studies are ranked by our impact algorithm, which weighs journal tier and level of evidence. Let's start with our first study. Kim and colleagues published in JSES, titled Patient-Specific Instrumentation versus a Freehand Technique for Glenoid Baseplate and Peripheral Screw Placement in Reverse Total Shoulder Arthroplasty, using the Exactech Implant System, a multicenter randomized controlled trial. This multicenter superiority randomized controlled trial across seven tertiary centers randomized patients 65 years and older undergoing primary reverse total shoulder arthroplasty with the Exactech system 1:1 to PSI versus freehand glenoid baseplate placement with CT-based deviation from preoperative plan as the primary outcome. Baseplate version, inclination, and positional offset were statistically equivalent between groups. PSI significantly improved peripheral screw accuracy, reducing clinically relevant anterior SI gap errors from 43.4% to 11.3%, and superior SI gap errors from 41.5% to 20.8%. One limitation to note is the study reports only imaging-based accuracy endpoints with no clinical outcomes or complication rates. Overall, PSI did not improve glenoid baseplate positioning versus freehand technique, with version error of 5 degrees plus or minus 5 degrees in both groups, but significantly reduced clinically relevant peripheral screw angular errors, including anterior SI gap errors, dropping from 43.4% to 11.3%. Moving on, Kateu and colleagues published in JOA, titled A Prospective, Single-Center, Randomized Controlled Study Comparing Non-Resurfacing versus resurfacing in a cohort of 250 posterior stabilized total knee arthroplasty with a minimum 5-year follow-up. This single-center randomized controlled trial randomized 250 primary PS total knee arthroplasty knees to patella resurfacing or non-resurfacing using the same patella-friendly implant, asking whether routine resurfacing improves clinical or radiographic outcomes at 5 years. Clinical outcome scores, including Knee Society score knee, Knee Society score function, forgotten joint score, Kujala, and Leal anterior knee pain scores were equivalent between groups. Secondary patella resurfacing was required in 4.5% of non-resurfacing knees versus patellar button revision in 1.8% of resurfacing knees, with no significant difference in overall patellofemoral revision rate at 3.8%. One limitation to note is the single-center design with a single implant system may not generalize to CR implants or designs without patella-friendly trochlear geometry. Overall, in 213 knees randomized to patella resurfacing versus non-resurfacing with a patella-friendly PS total knee arthroplasty, 5-year implant survival was equivalent at 93.6% versus 91.8%, with no significant difference in any clinical outcome score. Moving on, Gelber and colleagues published in American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled Bone Marrow Aspirate Concentrate Improves the Early Osseous Integration of Fresh Osteochondral Allografts in the Knee, a randomized controlled trial. This single-center randomized controlled trial asked whether BMAC augmentation improves osseous integration and clinical outcomes in fresh osteochondral allograft transplantation of the knee. CT using the ACTOCAS scoring system showed superior host graft junction integration in the BMAC group at 3 months only, with the non-BMAC group demonstrating better graft signal density at 12 months. International Knee Documentation Committee, Kujala, Western Ontario and McMaster University's Arthritis Index and Tegner scores were equivalent between groups at all time points through 24 months. One limitation to note is the trial is critically underpowered at 36 patients to detect differences in patient-reported outcomes. Overall, BMAC augmentation improved CT-assessed host graft junction integration at 3 months post-FOCA transplantation, but this advantage disappeared by 6 and 12 months with no difference in any patient-reported outcome at 2 years. Moving on, Bilodeau and colleagues published in JOT titled Patient-Reported Outcomes After Distal Radius Fractures Differ Across Geographic and Cultural Populations, a Global Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This systematic review and meta-analysis queried PubMed, Embase, and Cochrane for randomized controlled trials reporting disabilities of the arm, shoulder, and hand score, quick dash, PRWE, or visual analog score after volar locking plate fixation of OTA AO Foundation 23 distal radius fractures, then stratified results by country, continent, and cultural region. The analysis demonstrated significant between-study heterogeneity for all three patient-reported outcome instruments, with 7 to 9 cultural regions each showing significantly different pooled mean scores. The finding directly challenges the assumption that patient-reported outcome benchmarks derived from one cultural context apply universally. One limitation to note is English-language-only inclusion excludes a substantial proportion of Asian and non-Western randomized controlled trials. Overall, disabilities of the arm, shoulder, and hand score, PRWE, and visual analog score after volar locking plate fixation of distal radius fractures show statistically significant heterogeneity across up to 9 cultural regions, meaning outcomes from any single region cannot be globally generalized. Moving on. Hamilton and colleagues published in JOA titled A Randomized Controlled Trial to Compare a Mobile Bearing Cementless and Cemented Unicompartmental Knee, results of an investigational device exemption study in the United States. This single-blind, multi-center U.S. IDE randomized controlled trial compared cementless versus cemented mobile bearing medial unicompartmental knee arthroplasty using a 2-to-1 allocation ratio, with co-primary endpoints of survivorship, radiographic success, and knee society scores. 5-year Kaplan-Meier survivorship was 91.7% for cementless versus 95.6% for cemented. Radiographic success was 93.8% versus 97.4%. Knee society clinical and functional scores at 2 years were statistically identical at 95.5 versus 95.6 and 89.9 versus 89.8, respectively. One limitation to note is 5-year follow-up is insufficient to evaluate the primary theoretical advantage of cementless fixation, superior long-term survivorship beyond 10 years. Cementless mobile bearing unicompartmental knee arthroplasty achieved non-inferior 5-year survivorship at 91.7% versus cemented at 95.6%, with equivalent knee society scores and radiographic outcomes. Moving on. Hattis and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Translating Biomechanics to Clinic, Validating a Spine-Specific Wearable for Remote Functional Assessment. This single-center validation study tested whether a T1-mounted, spine-specific inertial measurement unit could replicate trunk kinematic measurements obtained simultaneously from a 10-camera marker-based motion capture system in 50 adults with degenerative or structural spine pathology. Sagittal plane intraclass correlation coefficient ranged 0.89 to 0.96, with root mean square deviation less than 5 degrees. Coronal and transverse plane intraclass correlation coefficient ranged 0.71 to 0.94, with moderate range of motion agreement. Waveform pattern correlations were strongest during lifting and sit to stand, reaching up to 0.99, and weakest during gait at as low as 0.60. One limitation to note is the study was conducted in a single laboratory session with no test retest or longitudinal data. Overall, a single T1-mounted inertial measurement unit demonstrated excellent agreement with 10-camera motion capture for sagittal plane trunk kinematics in spine patients with intraclass correlation coefficient 0.89 to 0.96 and root mean square deviation less than 5 degrees across gait, lifting, and sit-to-stand tasks. Moving on. Shaker and colleagues published in JOA, titled Hypothyroidism is Associated with Increased Medical and Surgical Complications Following Total Joint Arthroplasty, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This PRISMA-compliant meta-analysis quantified the impact of hypothyroidism on TJA outcomes by pooling 18 studies through October 2024. Hypothyroidism significantly increased odds of periprosthetic joint infection, odds ratio 1.69, periprosthetic fracture, odds ratio 1.26, blood transfusion, odds ratio 1.68, acute renal failure, odds ratio 1.23, anemia, odds ratio 1.25, and non-home discharge, odds ratio 1.47. Total knee arthroplasty subgroup analysis additionally demonstrated increased mortality, odds ratio 1.63, deep vein thrombosis, odds ratio 1.18, pulmonary embolism, odds ratio 1.50, and cardiac complications, odds ratio 1.21. While wound complications, dislocation, mechanical loosening, length of stay, and cost show no significant differences. One limitation to note is inability to stratify outcomes by thyroid function control status. Overall, hypothyroidism increases periprosthetic joint infection risk by 69% and periprosthetic fracture risk by 26%, following TJA across 18 studies and 4,622,479 procedures. Moving on, Yassin and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Predicting Clinically Important Difference in Lumbar Decompression Surgery, The Influence of Demographic, Clinical, and Radiographic Characteristics. This study identified preoperative predictors of ODI-MCID achievement of 12.8 points or greater that 1 year in 199 patients undergoing 1 to 4 level lumbar decompression. Stepwise logistic regression identified symptom duration less than 6 months. Baseline ODI greater than 41, pelvic tilt less than 20.9 degrees, and microdiscectomy procedure type as the 4 independent predictors. With subgroup analyses showing radiographic parameters additionally predicted laminectomy, laminotomy outcomes. Mean ODI improved from 41.9 to 16.3. But MCID achievement varied dramatically by risk score tier. One limitation to note is the risk score was developed and tested in the same 199-patient, single-center cohort. Without external validation, a 4-point preoperative risk score predicted MCID achievement ranging from 39% with 0 predictors to 100% with all 4 predictors in 199 lumbar decompression patients. Moving on, Forlenza and colleagues published in JOA titled Trends in Reimbursement for 1 versus 2-stage exchange arthroplasty for periprosthetic joint infection. This study analyzed reimbursement data from 199 patients enrolled in a randomized controlled trial comparing one-stage versus two-stage exchange for periprosthetic joint infection between 2016 and 2022, converting all values to 2022 inflation-adjusted dollars. Two-stage exchange yielded significantly higher mean reimbursement at $4,342 versus $3,382. Across both total hip arthroplasty and total knee arthroplasty, and across Medicare and private payers. An opportunity cost analysis demonstrated that the 43-minute operative time advantage of one-stage exchange could theoretically allow additional primary arthroplasties, potentially equalizing total surgeon reimbursement across a 10-case cohort. One limitation to note is the opportunity cost model is purely theoretical and does not account for real-world OR scheduling constraints or anesthesia availability. Overall, two-stage exchange reimbursement exceeds one stage by 28% at $4,342 versus $3,382, though a 43-minute operative time savings per case may equalize cumulative surgeon revenue across 10 cases. Kaneoka and colleagues published in JOA titled Preoperative Activity Levels in Patients Who Undergo Total Hip Arthroplasty Distinctively Affect the Postoperative Recovery Process and Forgotten Joint Score 12, a prospective cohort study using a triaxial accelerometer. This prospective cohort study examined whether preoperative objective physical activity measured via triaxial accelerometer predicts postoperative recovery trajectory and FJS-12 at 12 months in 212 patients undergoing total hip arthroplasty for unilateral hip OA. Patients were stratified by age and preoperative activity level. Total exercise time increased from median 2.23 to 3.45 MET hours postoperatively, and FJS-12 improved from 60.2 at 1 month to 75.0 at 12 months. Higher preoperative activity independently predicted better 12-month FJS-12, yet these patients only returned to baseline objective physical activity, while lower activity patients surpassed their preoperative levels. One limitation to note is patients were not stratified by surgical approach or implant type. Overall, Higher preoperative objective physical activity predicts better FJS-12 at 12 months post-total hip arthroplasty, but these patients only recover to baseline activity levels, while lower activity patients exceed their preoperative step counts by 12 months. Moving on, Greenhill and colleagues published in JAAOS, titled Computed Tomography Overestimates Rankinographic Posterior Tilt in Geriatric Garden 1-2 Femoral Neck Fractures. This study asked whether posterior tilt measured on CT corresponds to plain radiograph measurement in elderly patients with Garden 1-2 femoral neck fractures using paired imaging in 100 patients 65 years and older. CT consistently overestimated posterior tilt relative to radiograph at 14 degrees versus 9 degrees, and identified 17 patients, 17%, above the 20-degree threshold compared to only 2% on radiograph. The 15 patients reclassified by CT alone had a mean posterior tilt difference of 24 degrees, a clinically significant discordance with direct arthroplasty versus fixation implications. One limitation to note is no clinical outcomes data are included regarding whether CT-measured posterior tilt of 20 degrees or greater carries the same prognostic weight as the radiograph-derived threshold. Overall, CT-measured posterior tilt averaged 14 degrees versus 9 degrees on plain radiograph. Reclassifying an additional 15% of Garden 1-2 femoral neck fractures as exceeding the 20-degree arthroplasty consideration threshold. Moving on, Kayali and colleagues published in JAAOS, titled Effect of Glucagon-like Peptide 1 Receptor Agonist Use on Fusion Outcomes After First Metatarsophalangeal Arthrodesis in Patients with Type 2 Diabetes Mellitus. This retrospective TriNetX database study compared one-year pseudarthrosis and complication rates after first MTPJ arthrodesis in GLP-1 RA users versus non-users, with propensity score matching for age, sex, obesity, hypertension, peripheral vascular disease, smoking, and HbA1c. In the overall matched cohort, pseudarthrosis rates were equivalent at 7.2% versus 8.2%. In the type 2 diabetes mellitus subgroup, GLP-1 RA users had a 35% relative risk reduction in pseudarthrosis at 7.7% versus 11.8%. With no difference in surgical site infection, implant pain, or implant removal. One limitation to note is retrospective database design cannot establish causality. Overall, among type 2 diabetes mellitus patients undergoing first MTPJ arthrodesis, GLP-1 RA use reduced pseudarthrosis rate from 11.8% to 7.7% at 1 year. Moving on, Sripadral and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled A Systematic Review of the Role of Wearable Devices and Artificial Intelligence Applications in Assessing Functional Outcomes After Lumbar Fusion. This PRISMA-compliant systematic review of PubMed assessed wearable device use for functional outcome monitoring before and after lumbar fusion. 9 studies with 813 patients met inclusion criteria. All were pre-post in design with heterogeneous devices and outcomes, most commonly steps per day. Wearable devices were associated with reduced ER visits and earlier complication detection, but no randomized controlled trial level evidence exists, and cost-effectiveness remains unestablished. One limitation to note is all 9 included studies were uncontrolled pre-post designs. Overall, only 9 studies with 813 patients met inclusion criteria for wearable device use in lumbar fusion outcomes, with steps per day as the primary metric in 55% of studies, revealing a near-complete absence of standardized evidence in this space. Moving on, Phillips and colleagues published in JAAOS, titled The Effect of Technological Innovations in Reverse Total Shoulder Arthroplasty on the Rate of Periprosthetic Acromion and Scapular Spine Fractures. This single-surgeon, single-implant platform retrospective study evaluated whether successive technological innovations in reverse total shoulder arthroplasty, grouped into 5 cohorts based on implant design, surgical technique, and virtual planning milestones, were associated with reduced acromion and scapular spine fracture incidence. Overall acromion and scapular spine fracture rate was 5.4%. with rotator cuff deficient patients carrying significantly higher risk than cuff intact patients at 7.39% versus 2.8%. though this gap disappeared after 2014. A logarithmic decline in acromion and scapular spine fracture incidence across the study period, with an R-squared of 0.765, was temporally associated with technology adoption, and year-to-year variability in acromion and scapular spine fracture rate dropped from 5.33% to 0.45% following routine implementation of preoperative virtual planning. One limitation to note is temporal confounding. Surgeon experience accumulating over 17 years is inseparable from technology adoption. Overall, across 2,380 reverse total shoulder arthroplasty cases over 17 years, overall acromion and scapular spine fracture incidence was 5.4%, but dropped significantly with successive technological advances, with year-to-year variability falling from 5.33% to 0.45% after routine preoperative virtual planning was adopted. Moving on, Mose and colleagues published in JSES titled GLP-1 Receptor Agonist Therapy is not associated with adverse events following shoulder surgery, a systematic review and meta-analysis. This PRISMA-compliant meta-analysis asked whether GLP-1 agonist use is associated with adverse events after shoulder surgery by pooling 6 comparative studies across total shoulder arthroplasty, rotator cuff repair, and manipulation under anesthesia capsular release cohorts. Pooled 90-day total shoulder arthroplasty complication rates were 18.1% versus 15.9%. Odds ratio 0.86, 95% confidence interval 0.36 to 2.07, and 2-year rates were 3.8% versus 3.7%. Odds ratio 1.24, 95% confidence interval 0.73 to 2.00 for GLP-1 users versus non-users. In the single rotator cuff repair study, GLP-1 users had markedly lower 90-day complications at 11.0% versus 27.4%, and lower 2-year re-tear rates at 12.5% versus 18.3%. One limitation to note is the arthroscopic subgroup findings, each derived from a single non-pooled study. Overall, GLP-1 receptor agonist use was not associated with increased 90-day or 2-year complications after total shoulder arthroplasty, and GLP-1 users showed lower re-tear rates after rotator cuff repair at 12.5% versus 18.3% in this meta-analysis of 43,415 patients. Moving on, Williamson and colleagues published in JAAOS titled A Proposed Preoperative Risk Score for Predicting Surgical Site Complications After Ankle Fracture Fixation in Frail Elderly Patients. This study asked whether a composite frailty-based score could predict surgical site complications after ankle fracture open reduction and internal fixation in elderly patients better than existing individual indices. Using a national database and backstep logistical regression, the authors derived the FAIR score from age, revised risk analysis index, and geriatric nutritional risk index. The FAIR score demonstrated good discriminatory accuracy, AUC 0.814, for surgical site infection or wound dehiscence, with an odds ratio of 3.2, 95% confidence interval 1.9 to 5.4, while the overall 30-day complication rate was 2.4%. One limitation to note is the FAIR score was derived and tested within the same national database without external validation. Overall, a novel FAIR score combining age, revised risk analysis index, and geriatric nutritional risk index predicts 30-day surgical site infection or wound dehiscence after ankle fracture open reduction and internal fixation with an AUC of 0.814 versus AUC of 0.517 or less for any individual index alone. Moving on, Brady and colleagues published in JOA titled To Fix or Replace, a systematic review and meta-analysis on surgical management of acetabular fractures in the elderly. This systematic review and meta-analysis compared open reduction and internal fixation versus acute total hip arthroplasty or hemiarthroplasty for acetabular fractures in patients 60 years and older across 13 comparative studies. Open reduction and internal fixation patients were significantly younger by 4.14 years and had lower American Society of Anesthesiologists scores, introducing substantial selection bias. Despite this, open reduction and internal fixation carried a 2.6-fold higher reoperation rate, with 84% of reoperations being conversion to total hip arthroplasty for post-traumatic OA at median 14.7 months, and yielded inferior Harris hip scores at 1 to 2 years by 6.11 points. One limitation to note is systematic selection bias. Open reduction and internal fixation patients were 4 years younger, with lower American Society of Anesthesiologists scores. Overall, in patients 60 years and older with acetabular fractures, acute total hip arthroplasty or hemiarthroplasty reduced reoperation risk 2.6-fold compared to open reduction and internal fixation, and yielded Harris hip scores 6.11 points higher at 1 to 2 years. Moving on, Andriolo and colleagues published in BJJ, titled Line-to-Line Cementation in Hip Arthroplasty, What is the Current Role of the French Paradox? This PRISMA-compliant systematic review evaluated clinical outcomes, biomechanical data, and controversies surrounding the French paradox technique. Line-to-line femoral component insertion with a thin variable cement mantle in primary total hip arthroplasty. Biomechanical studies demonstrated superior rotational stability versus standard undersized cementing, including in osteoporotic bone. Clinical cohorts reported greater than 90% implant survival at 10 and 17 years, with subsidence and migration patterns non-inferior to conventional technique, and no identified increase in aseptic loosening. One limitation to note is the absence of a pooled quantitative analysis and lack of standardized definition of line-to-line cementing across studies. Overall, line-to-line cementation achieves greater than 90% implant survival at 10 and 17 years across multiple cohorts, with rotational stability and subsidence comparable to or better than standard undersized cementing. Moving on, Li and colleagues published in JOA, titled The Impact of Glucagon-like Peptide 1 Receptor Agonist Use on Clinical Outcomes After Total Hip and Knee Arthroplasty, a systematic review and meta-analysis of 346,899 patients. This systematic review and meta-analysis evaluated GLP-1 RA use on perioperative outcomes following total hip arthroplasty and total knee arthroplasty across 13 studies queried through June 2025. GLP-1 RA use was associated with lower 90-day periprosthetic joint infection risk in total knee arthroplasty, odds ratio 0.75, 95% confidence interval 0.57 to 1.00, lower 90-day revision in total hip arthroplasty, odds ratio 0.76, 95% confidence interval 0.59 to 0.98, and reduced readmission rates in both procedures. However, GLP-1 RA use was associated with increased myocardial infarction risk in total knee arthroplasty patients. Odds ratio 1.39, 95% confidence interval 1.05 to 1.85. And no significant aspiration or pneumonia risk was identified. Odds ratio 1.09. One limitation to note is all 13 included studies are observational with inherent confounding by indication. Overall, GLP-1 RA use was associated with reduced 90-day periprosthetic joint infection risk after total knee arthroplasty. Odds ratio 0.75. Reduced 90-day revision after total hip arthroplasty, odds ratio 0.76, and decreased readmissions, but carried an elevated myocardial infarction risk after total knee arthroplasty, odds ratio 1.39, across 346,899 patients. Moving on, Fredrickson and colleagues published in American Journal of Sports Medicine, titled Cost-Effectiveness of Adding Remplissage to Bankart Repair for On-Track Hill-Sachs Lesions, a Markov decision analysis. This Markov decision analysis compared isolated arthroscopic Bankart repair versus Bankart repair with remplissage in patients with on-track Hill-Sachs lesions and subcritical glenoid bone loss over a 10-year societal prospective horizon. Bankart repair with remplissage generated 8.59 qualies at $24,980 versus 8.18 qualies at $23,333 for isolated Bankart repair, yielding an incremental cost-effectiveness ratio well below standard willingness-to-pay thresholds. Bankite repair with Remplissage was cost-effective in 99.89% and 99.99% of simulations at $50,000 per quali and $60,000 per quali thresholds, respectively, with model sensitivity driven primarily by recurrence probability inputs. One limitation to note is the model's dominant driver is recurrence probability, yet the input data derived from studies with median follow-up under 3 years. Overall, Bankite repair with Remplissage for on-track Hill-Sachs lesions yields 0.41 additional qualies at $1,647 incremental cost over 10 years, achieving cost-effectiveness in 99.89% of simulations at a $50,000 per quali willingness to pay threshold. Moving on, Ang and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Outpatient Anterior Cervical Discectomy and Fusion on the Rise: Changing Economics and Utilization Patterns in U.S. Hospital-Owned Ambulatory Surgical Centers. This retrospective cross-sectional analysis of the NASS database characterized national trends in volume, payer mix, and inflation-adjusted charges for single-level ACDF performed in hospital-owned ASCs from 2016 to 2022. Case volume more than doubled over the study period. Median patient age rose from 52 to 57 years. And Medicare's payer share increased from 8.6% to 29%, while private insurance fell from 74% to 53%. Overall geometric mean charge was $57,600, with Western region procedures 41% more expensive than the Northeast, and significant variation by payer and season. One limitation to note is the NAS database is restricted to hospital-owned ASCs, excluding the large and growing independent ASC sector. Overall, single-level ACDF volume in hospital-owned ASCs more than doubled from 33,687 cases in 2016 to 73,024 in 2021, with Medicare share of payer mix expanding from 8.6% to 29% over the same period. Moving on. Secchi and colleagues published in JSES, titled Survival and Long-Term Minimum 10-Year Outcomes of Bony Increased Offset Reverse Shoulder Arthroplasty. This single-center retrospective study with prospectively collected data evaluated survival and long-term outcomes of BIORSA in 196 shoulders treated for osteoarthritis with cuff deficiency between 2006 and 2014. At minimum 10-year follow-up, Kaplan-Meier survival with revision as endpoint was 98%. Four revisions occurred, three for glenoid loosening, one for periprosthetic fracture. All glenoid failures occurred within 5 years, and CT confirmed full graft incorporation in 95% of assessed shoulders. Severe scapular notching grade 3 to 4 was present in 32% and was significantly associated with superior glenoid tilt, while no dislocations occurred and acromion and scapular spine fractures were observed in only 2%. One limitation to note is radiographic and CT analysis was performed on only 41 of 104 available shoulders. Overall, BIORSA achieves 98% prosthesis survival at mean 12.7 years, with 95% complete bone graft incorporation and zero instability events, though severe scapular notching occurred in 32% of shoulders. Moving on, Koch and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Dynamic Compensation in Spinopelvic Alignment and Its Relation to Symptom Severity in Patients with Lumbar Spinal Stenosis. This cross-sectional study asked whether dynamic spinopelvic compensation during gait, derived from motion capture data offset corrected with EOS radiography, correlates with symptom severity better than static standing parameters in 119 surgical candidates with symptomatic lumbar spinal stenosis. Static alignment parameters during stance or gait showed no correlation with ODI. Dynamic pelvic tilt compensation and spinosacral angle compensation during gait showed weak but significant associations with ODI, with greater pelvic retroversion during gait versus stance, predicting higher disability. One limitation to note is correlation magnitudes are weak. Overall, in 119 patients with symptomatic lumbar spinal stenosis, dynamic pelvic compensation during gait, not static standing alignment, correlated with ODI disability. Moving on, Chang and colleagues published in JSES, titled Is Subscapularis Repair Beneficial in Patients Undergoing Reverse Shoulder Arthroplasty for Glenohumeral Osteoarthritis with an Intact Rotator Cuff? Evaluation of a Treatment Protocol. This retrospective study examined whether selective subscapularis repair affects outcomes in 80 patients undergoing reverse total shoulder arthroplasty with a lateralized glenoid inlay humerus design for intact cuff glenohumeral OA. With repair performed in 50 patients, 62.5%, when it did not limit intraoperative passive external rotation. At minimum 1-year follow-up, patient-reported outcome measures were equivalent between groups, but the repair group demonstrated superior internal rotation ranges motion, PAS 93.8% versus 75.9%, and strength at all time points. While the no repair group achieved greater active external rotation improvement, 32.5 degrees versus 20.8 degrees, and higher sustained clinical benefit rates for active external rotation, 90.0% versus 60.4%. No instability occurred in either group. One limitation to note is the retrospective design with inherent selection bias. The repair group had significantly better preoperative active external rotation. Overall, subscapularis repair in reverse total shoulder arthroplasty for intact cuff glenohumeral OA yields superior internal rotation range of motion, PAS rate 93.8% versus 75.9%, and early patient-reported outcome measures at 3 to 6 months, but no patient-reported outcome measure difference at minimum 1-year follow-up, with the unrepaired group achieving greater active external rotation improvement, 32.5 degrees versus 20.8 degrees. And finally, Dechmi and colleagues published in Spine Journal, titled Cost-Effectiveness of Early Surgical Intervention for Asymptomatic Cervical Spinal Cord Compression, a Markov Model Analysis. This Markov model compared early ACDF versus observation with delayed surgery for asymptomatic cervical spinal cord compression in a Medicare-aged cohort, using 7 health states and 10,000 Monte Carlo simulations. Observation yielded 15.01 qualies at $8,066 versus early ACDF at 15.26 qualies and $28,106, producing an incremental cost-effectiveness ratio of $83,015 per quali. Early surgery generated 9,996 surgeries and 3,040 reoperations per 10,000 patients versus 8,843 surgeries and 2,049 reoperations under observation, and was cost-effective in only 35.5% of simulations at $50,000 per quali and 56.2% at $100,000 per quali. One limitation to note is the model lacks empirically validated patient-level progression rate data for asymptomatic cervical spinal cord compression. Overall, early ACDF for asymptomatic cervical spinal cord compression yields an incremental cost-effectiveness ratio of $83,015 per quali and is cost-effective in only 56.2% of simulations at a $100,000 quali threshold, requiring annual progression rates greater than 3.5% asymptomatic to mild, or greater than 11% mild to moderate, to become economically justified. That wraps up this week's Ortho Digest Rundown, 25 studies reviewed. Head to orthodigest.com for the full write-ups. Until next week.